just facts and meant nothing. Anger tightened my shoulders and traveled down my arms. I put my hands in fists just to have something to do with my body.
You bastard.
Maybe, he said. But be careful what you ask me to do, Anita. Just walking out could do more damage than the truth.
I stared at him, trying to see behind that blank face. Have you thought about telling Donna the truth?
No.
Damn you.
Do you really think she could handle the truth, the entire truth about me?
He asked. I thought about that for nearly a minute while we stood in the heat-soaked parking lot. Finally, I said,
no.
I didn't like saying it, but truth was truth.
You're sure she couldn't play wife to an assassin? I mean, you've only met her for half an hour. How can you be so sure?
Now you're teasing me, I said. His lips twitched almost a smile.
I think you are exactly right. I don't think Donna could handle the truth.
I shook my head, hard enough that my hair lashed my face. I literally threw my hands in the air. Fuck it for now. I didn't get on a plane at a moment's notice to stand in the heat and discuss your love life. Don't we have a crime to solve or something?
We could discuss your love life,
he said.
Werewolf or vampire, which are you fucking now?
There was something close to bitterness in his voice. It wasn't jealousy, but utter disapproval. You killed the monsters. You did not date them. It was one of Edward's rules, and used to be one of mine. Just another example of my moral downfall. Neither, actually, and that is all I'm going to say on the subject. He lowered his sunglasses enough so I could see his pale blue eyes.
You dumped them both?
He actually sounded interested. I shook my head. If I feel like sharing, I'll let you know. Now tell me what the hell you've dragged me into besides your sordid love life. Tell me about the murders, Edward. Tell me why I'm really here. He slipped the glasses back over his eyes and gave a small nod.
Okay.
He opened the driver's side door and left me to let myself into the passenger side. He'd held Donna's door for her, but that wasn't the kind of relationship Edward and I had. If we might have to start shooting each other, I'd get my own doors. Chapter 4. The car belonged to Ted, even though Edward was driving it. It was a square and big something between a jeep, a truck, and an ugly car. It was covered in red clay mud as if he'd been driving through ditches. The windshield was so dirty, only two fans of clear space remained where the windshield wipers had washed away the mud. Everything else had dried to a reddish-brown patina of dirt.
Gee, Edward, I said as he opened the back hatch. What have you been doing to this poor whatever it is? I've never seen a car so dirty.
This is a Hummer, and cost more than most people's houses.
He raised the hatch and started putting my bags inside. I offered him my carry-on, and when I was close could smell that new car smell, which explained why the carpeting in back was still nearly pristine.
If it costs that much, then why doesn't it rate better care? I asked.
He took the carry-on and put it on the new carpet.
I bought it because it could go over almost any terrain in almost any weather. If I didn't want it to get dirty, I'd have bought something else.
He slammed the hatch shut. How can Ted afford something like this?
Actually, Ted makes a fine living off varmint hunting.
Not this good, I said. Not off of bounty hunting.
How do you know what a bounty hunter makes?
He asked, peering around the filthy car at me.
He had a point.
I guess I don't.
Most people don't know what a bounty hunter makes, so I can get away with some purchases that might be out of Ted's price range.
He walked around the car toward the driver's side, only the top of his white hat showing above the mud-caked roof. I tried the passenger side door and it opened. It took a little bit of work to climb into the seat, and I was glad I wasn't wearing a skirt. One nice thing about working with Edward was that he wouldn't expect me to wear business attire. It was jeans and Nikes for this trip. The only business thing I was wearing was the black jacket slung over my cotton shirt and jeans. The jacket was to hide the gun, nothing more. What are the gun laws like in New Mexico? Edward started the car and glanced at me.
Why?
I put on my seatbelt. Evidently we were in a hurry. I want to know if I can ditch the jacket and wear my gun naked, or whether I'm going to have to hide the gun for the entire trip. His lips twitched.
New Mexico lets you carry, as long as it's not concealed. Concealed carry without a permit is illegal.
Let me test my understanding. I can wear the gun in full view of everyone, with or without a carry permit, but if I put a jacket over it, concealing it, and don't have a carry permit, it's illegal? The twitch turned into a smile.
That's right.
Western state gun laws are always so interesting, I said, but I started sliding out of the jacket. You can wiggle out of almost anything while remaining seat-belted in a car.
Since I always wear a seatbelt, I'd had a lot of practice.
But the police may still stop you if they see you walking around armed. Just make sure you're not here to kill anybody.
He half smiled when he said the last. So I can carry as long as it's not concealed, but not really, not without getting questioned by the police.
And you can't carry a gun of any kind, even unloaded, into a bar.
I don't drink. I think I can avoid the bars. A wire fence edged the road he pulled onto, but did nothing to take away the flat, flat distances and the strange black mountains. What are the mountains called?
Sangre del Cristo, the blood of Christ, he said.
I looked at him to see if he was kidding. Of course, he wasn't.
Why? Why what?
Why call them the blood of Christ?
I don't know.
How long has Ted lived out here?
Almost 4 years, he said.
And you don't know why the mountains are named Sangre del Cristo? Do you have no curiosity?
Not about things that don't affect the job.
He didn't say a job, but the job. I thought it was odd phrasing. What if this monster that we're hunting is some kind of local bugaboo? Knowing why the mountains are named what they're named may mean nothing, or it may have to do with a legend, a story, a hint about some great bloodbath in the past. There are very localized monsters, Edward. Things that only come above ground every century or so, like really long-lived cicadas.
Cicadas?
He asked. Yeah, cicadas. The immature form stays in the ground until every 13 or 7 or whatever their cycle is years, they climb out, molt, and become adults. They're the insects that make all that noise in the summertime.
Whatever did those people wasn't a giant cicada, Anita.
That's not the point, Edward. My point is that there are types of living creatures that stay hidden, almost totally hidden, for years, then resurface. Monsters are still a part of the natural world. Preternatural biology is still biology. So maybe old myths and legends would give us a clue.
I didn't bring you down here to play Nancy Drew, he said.
Yes, you did, I said. He looked at me long enough to make me want to tell him to watch the road.
What are you talking about?
If you just wanted someone to point and shoot, you'd have brought in someone else. You want my expertise, not just my gun, right? He turned back to the road, much to my relief. There were small houses on either side, most of them made of adobe or faux adobe. I didn't know enough about it to judge. The yards were small but well-tended, running high to cacti and huge lilac bushes with surprisingly small bundles of pale lavender flowers on them. It looked like a different variety from the lilacs in the Midwest. Maybe it took less water. Silence had filled the car, and I let it, watching the scenery. I'd never been to Albuquerque, and I'd play tourist while I could. Edward finally answered me when he turned onto Lomos Street.
You're right. I didn't ask you down here just to shoot things. I already have backup for that.
Who? I asked.
You don't know them, but you'll meet them in Santa Fe.
We're driving straight to Santa Fe now? I haven't eaten yet today. I was sort of hoping to catch some lunch.
The latest crime scene is in Albuquerque. We'll catch it, then lunch.
Will I feel like eating afterwards?
Maybe.
I don't suppose I could talk you into lunch first, then.
We've got to stop before we hit the house, he said.
What other stop? I asked. He just gave that small smile, which meant it was going to be a surprise. Edward loved to try my patience. Maybe he'd answer a different question. Who's your other backup?
I told you you don't know them.
You keep saying them. Are you saying that you already have two people for backup and you still needed to call me in, too? He didn't say anything to that. Three people backing you on this? Geez, Edward, you must be desperate. I'd meant for it to be a joke, sort of. He didn't take it that way.
I want this case solved, Anita, whatever it takes.
He looked grim when he said it. So much for my sense of humor. Do these two backups owe you a favor?
One does.
Are they assassins?
Sometimes.
Bounty hunters like Ted?
Bernardo is.
At least I had a name. Bernardo is a sometimes assassin and a bounty hunter like Ted. You mean he uses his bounty hunting identity, like you use yours as a legal identity?
Sometimes he's a bodyguard, too.
A man of many talents, I said.
Not really, he said,
which was a strange thing to say. What about the other guy?
Olaf.
Olaf, okay. He's sometimes an assassin, not a bounty hunter, not a bodyguard, and what else? Edward shook his head. His noncommittal answers were beginning to get on my nerves. Do either of them have any other special abilities besides being willing to kill?
Yes.
He'd reached my limit on yes-no answers. I didn't come down here to play 20 questions, Edward. Just tell me about the other backups.
You'll meet them soon enough. Fine, then tell me where the other stop is. He gave a small shake of his head.
Look, Edward, you're getting on my nerves, and you've already pissed me off, so cut the mysterious crap and talk to me.
He glanced sideways at me, a glimpse of eyes from the edges of the dark glasses.
My, my, aren't we touchy today?
This isn't even close to touchy for me, Edward, and you know it. But keep up the non-committal crap, and you are going to truly piss me off.
I thought you were already pissed off about Donna.
I am, I said. But I'm willing to get interested in the case and forget to be continuously pissed. But I can't get interested in the case if you don't answer questions about it. As far as I'm concerned, your backup is part of the case, so either start sharing info or drive me back to the damn airport.
I didn't tell Olaf and Bernardo you're shacking up with a vampire and a werewolf.
Actually, I'm not dating either of them anymore, but that's not the point. I don't want to know about their sex life, Edward. I just want to know why you called them in. What are their areas of expertise?
You broke up with Jean-Claude and Richard both?
For one of the few times since I'd met him, I heard real curiosity in his voice. I wasn't sure if it was nice to know or disturbing that my personal life interested Edward.
I don't know if we broke up. It's more like we aren't seeing each other. I need some time away from them before I decide what to do.
What are you thinking about doing to them?
And there was a note of eagerness now. Edward was only eager about one thing. I am not planning to kill either of them, if that's what you're hinting at.
I can't say I'm not disappointed,
Edward said.
I think you should have killed Jean-Claude yourself before it all got too deep.
You're talking about killing someone who has been my lover off and on for over a year, Edward. Maybe you could strangle Donna in her bed, but I'd lose sleep over something like that.
Do you love him?
The question stopped me. Not because of the question, but because of who was asking it. It seemed a truly odd question coming from Edward. Yeah, I think I do.
Do you love Richard?
Again, it seemed odd talking about my emotional life with Edward. I have a few male friends, and most of them would rather have a root canal than talk about feelings. Of all my male friends, I was talking to the one I thought would never discuss love with me. It just wasn't my year for understanding men.
Yes, I love Richard.
You say you think you love the vampire, but you simply answer yes about Richard. Kill the vampire, Anita. I'll help you do it.
Not to put too fine a point on it, Edward, but I'm Jean-Claude's human servant. Richard is his animal to call. The three of us are bound by vampire marks into a nice little menage a trois. If one of us dies, we may all die.
Maybe. Or maybe that's what the vampire tells you. It wouldn't be the first time he's lied to you.
It was impossible to argue without looking like a fool, so I didn't try. When I want your advice on my personal life, I'll ask for it. Until people start ice skating in hell, save your breath. Now tell me about the case.
You get to tell me who to date and who not to, but I can't return the favor?
He asked. I looked at him. Are you angry with me about my stand on Donna?
Not exactly. But if you get to give me advice on dating, why can't I return the favor?
It's not the same thing, Edward. Richard doesn't have kids.
Children make that big a difference to you?
He asked. I nodded. Yeah, they do.
I never figured you as the maternal type.
I'm not, but kids are people, Edward. Little people trapped by the choices the adults around them make. Donna's old enough to make her own mistakes, but when you screw her, you're screwing her kids, too. I know that doesn't bother you, but it bothers me.
I knew it would. I even knew how you'd react, but I don't know why.
Well, you're one ahead of me. I never dreamed you were boffing New Age widows with munchkins. I figured you more for the pay-as-you-go plan.
Ted doesn't pay for it, he said.
How about Edward? He shrugged.
It's like eating. Just another need.
The cold bluntness of it was actually reassuring. See, that's the Edward I've grown to know and be afraid of.
You're afraid of me, but yet you'd come against me for a woman you just met and two kids you don't even know. I'm not even planning to kill any of them, and yet you'd push the ultimate question between us.
He shook his head.
I don't understand that.
Don't understand it, Edward. Just know it's true.
I believe you, Anita. You're the only person I know except for me that never bluffs.
Bernardo and Olaf bluff? I gave it that extra little lilt, making it a question. He shook his head and laughed. The tension that had been building eased with that laugh.
No, I'm not giving you anything on them.
Why? I asked.
Because,
he said, and he almost smiled. I looked at his careful profile.
You're enjoying this.
You're enjoying Olaf and Bernardo meeting me. I didn't try and keep the surprise out of my voice.
Just like I enjoyed you meeting Donna.
Even though you knew I'd be pissed, I said. He nodded.
The look on your face was almost worth a death threat.
I shook my head. You're beginning to worry me, Edward.
Just beginning to worry you? I must be losing my touch.
Fine, don't tell me about them. Tell me about the case. He pulled into a parking lot. I looked up to find a hospital looming over us. Is this the crime scene?
No.
He pulled into a parking spot and shut the engine off. What gives, Edward? Why are we at a hospital?
The survivors are here.
My eyes widened. What survivors? He looked at me.
The survivors from the attacks.
He opened his door, and I grabbed his arm, holding him in the car. Edward turned slowly and looked at my hand on the bare skin of his arm. He looked at my hand a long time, with his disapproval at the touch radiating from him, but it was a trick I'd pulled myself more than once. If the person makes it known that they don't want to be touched, most people that don't mean you violence will back off. I didn't back off. I dug my fingers into his skin, not to hurt, just to let him know he wasn't getting rid of me that easily. Talk to me, Edward. What survivors? He shifted his gaze from my hand to my face. I had an urge to snatch the sunglasses from his face, but fought it. His eyes wouldn't show me anything anyway.
I told you there were injured people.
His voice was mild. No, you didn't. You made it sound like there were no survivors.
My oversight, he said.
My ass, I said. I know you enjoy being mysterious, Edward, but it's getting tedious.
Let go of my arm.
He said it the way you'd say hello or nice day, no inflection at all. Will you answer my questions if I do?
No,
he said, still with that same pleasant, empty voice.
But if you make this a pissing contest, Anita, I'll feel compelled to make you let go. You wouldn't like that.
The voice never changed. There was even a slight smile to his mouth. But I let go, slowly, drawing back into my seat. If Edward said I wouldn't like it, I believed him. Talk to me, Edward. He gave me a big old smile.
Call me Ted.
Then the son of a bitch got out of the car. I sat in the car, watching him walk across the parking lot. He stopped at the edge with the hospital just across a small road from him. He took off the sunglasses, slipped one of the earpieces into his shirt front, and stared back at the car, waiting. It would serve him right if I didn't get out. It would serve him right if I went back to St. Louis and let him clean up his own mess. But I opened the door and got out. Why, you might ask? One, he'd ask me for a favor, and being Edward, he'd reveal all in his own sadistic time. Two, I wanted to know. I wanted to know what had finally cut through all that coldness and scared him. I wanted to know. Curiosity is both a strength and a weakness. Which one this particular curiosity was wouldn't be answered for a while. I was betting on weakness. Chapter 5. St. Lucia Hospital was big, and one of the few buildings of any size in Albuquerque that I'd seen that didn't have a Southwest theme to it. It was just big and blocky, a generic hospital. Maybe they didn't expect the tourists to see the hospital. Lucky tourists. As hospitals go, it was nice, but it was still a hospital. A place I only go when things have gone wrong. The only upside this time was that it wasn't me or anyone I knew in the rooms. We were in a long, pale corridor with lots of closed doors, but there was a uniformed police officer in front of one of them. Call it a hunch, but I figured that was our room. Edward walked up to the policeman and introduced himself. He was at his good old boy best, harmless and jovial, in a subdued hospital sort of way. They knew each other on sight, which should have sped things up considerably. The uniform looked past Edward to me. He looked young, but his eyes were cool and gray, cop eyes. You have to be on the job a while before your eyes go empty. But he looked at me too long and too intently. You could almost feel the testosterone rising to the surface. The challenging look said that either he was insecure in his own masculinity, his own copness, or that he hadn't been on the job all that long. Not a rookie, but not much beyond it either. If he expected me to squirm under the scrutiny, he was going to be disappointed. I faced him, smiling, calm, eyes blank and close to bored. Passing inspection had never been my favorite thing. He blinked first.
The lieutenant is inside. He wants to see her before she goes inside.
Why?
Edward asked, voice still likable. The officer shrugged.
I'm just following orders, Mr. Forrester. I don't question my lieutenant. Wait here.
He opened the door and slipped inside without giving much of a glimpse inside. He shut the door behind him, not waiting for the weight and hinges to do it for him. Edward was frowning.
I don't know what's going on.
I do, I said. He looked at me, raising an eyebrow as if to say, go ahead. I'm a girl and technically a civilian. A lot of cops don't trust me to do the job.
I vouched for you.
Gee, Ted, I guess your opinion doesn't carry as much weight as you thought it did. He was still frowning at me with Edward's eyes when the door swung open. I was watching his face as he transformed into Ted. The eyes sparkled, the lips curved, the entire set of his face remade itself as if it were a mask. His own personality vanished like magic. Watching the show this up close and personal made me shiver just a bit. The ease with which he switched back and forth was just plain creepy. The man in the doorway was short, not many inches above me, maybe 5'6" at best. I wondered if their police force didn't have a height requirement. His hair was a golden, sun-streaked blonde, cut very short and close to his square-jawed face. He was tanned a nice soft gold, as if it were as dark a tan as his pale skin were capable of. First Donna, now the lieutenant. Didn't anyone sweat skin cancer here? He looked at me with green-gold eyes, the color of new spring leaves. They were beautiful eyes with long golden lashes and softened his face to an almost feminine appearance. Only the masculine jut of the jaw saved him from being one of those men who is beautiful instead of handsome. The jaw both ruined his face and saved it from perfection. The eyes may have been lovely, but they weren't friendly. It wasn't even the coolness of cop eyes. It was hostile. Since I'd never met him before, it had to be the fact that I was a woman, a civilian, and or an animator. He was either a chauvinist or superstitious. I wasn't sure which I preferred. He let me have a nice long dose of glaring. I just gave a blank face, waiting for him to get tired of it. I could stand there all day and be peacefully blank. Standing in a nice, safe hospital corridor wasn't even close to the worst thing I'd had to do lately. It was always sort of peaceful when no one was trying to kill me. Edward tried to break the stalemate.
Lieutenant Marks, this is Anita Blake. Chief Appleton called you about her.
He was still using Ted's happy voice, but there was a set to his shoulders that was stiff and not so happy.
You're Anita Blake, Lieutenant Marks managed to sound doubtful.
I nodded.
Yep.
His eyes narrowed.
I don't like civilians messing in my case.
He jerked a thumb at Edward.
Forrester here has proven himself valuable.
He pointed a finger at me.
You haven't.
Edward started to say something, but Marks cut him off with a sharp movement of his hand.
No, let her answer for herself.
I'll answer a question if you'll ask one, I said.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you haven't asked a question yet, Lieutenant. You've just made statements.
I don't need shit from some fucking zombie queen.
Ah, he was prejudiced. One mystery solved. I was invited down here, Lieutenant Marks. I was invited to help you solve this case. Now, if you don't want my help, fine. But I'll need someone from the city government to explain to my boss why the hell I got on a plane to New Mexico when I wasn't sure of my welcome.
I don't treat you right and you run to the powers that be, is that it?
I shook my head. Who got your panties in a twist, Marks? He frowned.
What?
Do I remind you of your ex-wife?
I'm married to my only wife.
He sounded indignant.
Congratulations.
Is it the voodoo that I use to raise the dead? Are you nervous around the mystical arts?
I don't like black magic.
He fingered the cross-shaped tie tack that was standard police issue almost everywhere, but somehow I thought Marks was serious about it.
I don't do black magic, Marks.
I drew on the silver chain around my neck until the crucifix spilled into the light. I'm Christian. Episcopalian, actually. I don't know what you've heard about what I do, but it's not evil.
You would say that, he said.
The state of my immortal soul is between God and myself, Lieutenant Marks. Judge not, lest ye be judged yourself. Or do you skip that part and just keep the parts you like? His face darkened, and a vein in his forehead started to pulse. This level of anger, even if he was a right-winger Christian extremist, was over the top. What in hell is behind that door to have you both so spooked? I asked. Marks blinked at me.
I am not spooked.
I shrugged. Yeah, you are. You're all bent out of shape about the survivors and you're taking it out on me.
You don't know me, he said.
No, but I know a lot of policemen, and I know when someone's scared. He stepped close enough to me that if it had been a fight, I'd have stepped back, put space between us. Instead, I stood my ground. I wasn't really expecting the lieutenant to take a swing at me.
You think you're so fucking tough?
I blinked at him, close enough that if I'd risen on tiptoe, I could have kissed him.
I don't think, Lieutenant. I know.
He smiled at that, but not like he was happy.
You think you can take it? Be my guest.
He stepped to one side, making a sweeping motion towards the door. I wanted to ask what was behind the door. What could possibly be so horrible that it had Edward and a police lieutenant this shaken? I stared at the closed door, smooth, hiding all its secrets.
What are you waiting for, Miss Blake? Go ahead. Open the door.
I glanced back at Edward. I don't suppose you'd give me a hint.
Open the door, Anita.
I muttered.
Bastard.
Under my breath, and opened the door. Chapter 6. The door didn't lead directly into the room. It led into a small antechamber with another sealed, mostly glass door beyond. There was a hush of air circulating through the room, as if the room had its own separate air supply. A man stood to one side wearing green surgical scrubs complete with little plastic booties over his feet, a mask hanging loose from his neck. He was tall and slender, without looking weak. He was also one of the first New Mexicans that I'd met without a tan. He handed me a pile of scrubs.
Put this on.
I took the clothes. Are you the doctor on this case?
No, I'm a nurse.
You got a name? He gave a small smile.
Ben. I'm Ben.
Thanks, Ben. I'm Anita. Why do I need the scrubs?
To guard against infection.
I didn't argue with him. My expertise was more in the line of taking lives, not preserving them. I'd bow to the experts. I put the scrubs over my jeans, tying the string tie as tight as it would go. The legs of the pants still bagged around my feet. Ben, the nurse, was smiling.
We weren't expecting them to send us a policeman so petite.
I frowned at him. Smile when you say that. His smile brightened in a flash of white teeth. The smile softened the face and made him seem less like Nurse Ratchet and more like a human being. And I'm not a cop. His eyes flicked to the gun in its shoulder holster. The gun was very black and very noticeable against the red shirt.
You're carrying a gun.
I slipped a short-sleeve shirt over my head and the offending gun. New Mexico law says I can carry as long as it's not concealed.
If you're not a policeman, then why do you need the gun?
I'm a vampire executioner. He held a long-sleeve gown out towards me. I slipped my arms through the sleeves. It tied in the back like most hospital gowns. Ben tied it for me.
I thought you couldn't kill a vampire with bullets.
Silver bullets can slow them down, and if they're not too old or too powerful, blowing a hole in their brain or heart works. Sometimes, I added. Wouldn't want Ben to get the wrong idea and try to take out an intruding vamp with silver ammo and get munched because he trusted my opinion. We had some trouble getting my hair up under the little plastic hair thing, but finally managed it, though the thin ridge of elastic that held it in place scraped the back of my neck every time I moved my head. Ben tried to help me with the surgical gloves, but I put them on myself. No problem. He raised eyebrows at me.
You've put on gloves before.
It wasn't a question. I wear them at crime scenes and when I don't want blood under my fingernails. He helped me tie the mask around my neck.
You must see a lot of blood in your line of work.
Not as much blood as you see, I bet. I turned with the mask over my mouth and nose. Only my eyes were left uncovered and real. Ben looked down at me, and his face looked thoughtful.
I'm not a surgical nurse.
What is your specialty? I asked.
Burn unit.
My eyes widened. Are the survivors burned? He shook his head.
No, but their bodies are still like open wounds, just like a burn. The protocol is similar.
What do you mean their bodies are an open wound? Someone tapped on the glass behind me, and I jumped, turning to see another man in an outfit just like mine glaring at me with pale eyes. He hit an intercom button, and his voice came clear enough to hear the irritation in it.
If you're coming inside, then do it. I want to sedate them again, and I can't do that until you've had a chance to question them, or so I'm told.
He let go of the button and walked farther away behind a white curtain that hid the rest of the room from view. Gee, I'm just on everybody's happy list today. Ben put on his mask and said,
Don't take it personally. Dr. Evans is good at what he does, one of the best.
If you want to find a good doctor in a hospital, don't ask other doctors or referral services. Ask a nurse. Nurses always know who's good and who's not. They may not say the bad stuff aloud, but if they say something good about a doctor, you can take it to the bank. Ben touched something on the wall that was a little too big to be called a button, and the doors whooshed open with a sound like an airlock opening. I stepped inside, and the doors hushed closed behind me. Nothing but the white curtain now. I didn't want to pull that curtain aside. Everyone was too damned upset. It was going to be bad. Their bodies were like open wounds, Ben had said, but not a burn. What had happened to them? As the old saying goes, only one way to find out. I took a deep breath and pushed the curtain aside. The room beyond was white and antiseptic-looking, a very hospital of a hospital room. Outside this room, there had been some attempt at pastels and a pretense that it was just a building, just hallways, just ordinary rooms. All pretense ended at the curtain, and reality was harsh. There were 6 beds, each with a whitish plastic hood/tent over the head of the beds and the upper bodies of the patients. Dr. Evans was standing beside the nearest bed. A woman in matching scrubs was farther into the room, checking one of the many blinking, beeping pieces of equipment that huddled around each bed. She glanced up, and the small area of her face that showed was a startling darkness. African-American, female, and not fat, but beyond that in height I couldn't tell anything under the protective clothing. I wouldn't recognize her again without the scrubs. It was strangely anonymous and disturbing. Or maybe that was just me. She dropped her gaze and moved to another bed, doing the same checks, writing something down on a clipboard. I walked towards the closest bed. Dr. Evans never turned around or acknowledged me in any way. White sheets formed tents over each patient, held up by some sort of framework to keep the sheet from touching them. Dr. Evans finally turned to one side so I could see the face of the patient. I blinked, and my eyes refused to see it. Or maybe my brain just rejected what I was seeing. The face was red and raw as if it should be bleeding, but it didn't bleed. It was like looking at raw meat in the shape of a human face. No, meaty skull. The nose had been cut off, leaving bloody holes for the plastic tubes to be shoved inside. The man rolled brown eyes in his sockets, staring up at me. There was something wrong with his eyes beyond the lack of skin around them. It took me a few seconds to realize his eyelids had been cut off. The room was suddenly warm, so warm, and the mask was suffocating me. I wanted to pull it off so I could breathe. I must have made some movement because the doctor grabbed my wrist. "Don't take anything off. I'm risking their lives with every new person that comes in here." He let go of my wrist. "Make the risk worth it. Tell me what did this." I shook my head, concentrating on breathing slowly in and out. When I could talk, I asked, "What's the rest of the body look like?" He stared at me, his eyes demanding. I met his gaze. Anything was better than looking at what lay in the bed. "You're pale already. Are you sure you want to see the rest?" "No," I said truthfully. Even with just his eyes visible, I could see the surprise on his face. "I would like nothing better than to turn and walk out of this room and keep walking," I said. "I don't need any new nightmares, Dr. Evans, but I was called in here to give my expert opinion. I can't form an opinion without seeing the whole show. If I thought I didn't need to see it all, trust me, I wouldn't ask." "What do you hope to gain by it?" he asked. "I'm not here to gape at them, Doctor, but I'm looking for clues to what did this. Most of the time, the clues are on the bodies of the victims." The man in the bed made small jerks, head tossing from side to side as if he were in a great deal of pain. Small, helpless noises came from his lipless mouth. I closed my eyes and tried to breathe normally. "Please, Doctor, I need to see." I opened my eyes in time to see him rolling back the sheet. I watched him roll it back, folding it carefully, revealing the man's body an inch at a time. By the time I saw him to the waist, I knew that he'd been skinned alive. I'd hoped it was just the face. That was awful enough on its own, but it takes a hell of a long time to skin a grown man's entire body. A long, screaming eternity to do it this well and this thoroughly. When the sheet rolled back over the groin, I swayed just a little. It wasn't a man. The groin area was smooth and raw. I glanced back up at the chest. The bone structure looked male. I shook my head. "Is this a man or a woman?"
"Man," he said.
I stared down and couldn't keep from staring at the groin and what was missing. Shit. I said softly. I closed my eyes again. It was so hot, so very hot. With my eyes closed, I could hear the hiss of the oxygen, the whisper of the nurse's booties as she came towards us, and small sounds from the bed as he twitched and strained against padded restraints at his wrists and ankles. Restraints? I'd seen them, but hadn't really registered them. All I could see was the body. Yes, body. I couldn't keep thinking of the man as a he. I had to distance myself or I was going to lose it. Concentrate on business. I opened my eyes. Why the restraints? My voice was breathy but clear. I glanced down at the body, then back up, giving Dr. Evans the most complete eye contact I'd ever given. I'd stare at him until I memorized the light crow's feet around his eyes, if I just didn't have to keep looking at what lay on the bed. They keep trying to get up and leave, he said. I frowned, not that he could see it under the mask. Surely they're too hurt to get far. We've got them on some very strong painkillers. When the pain dies down, they try to leave. All of them? I asked. He nodded. I made myself look back to the bed. Why isn't this just a case of a serial... not killer. What would you call it? A serial... I shook my head. I couldn't think of a word for it. Why was I called in? I'm a preternatural expert, and this could have been done by a person. There are no blade marks on the tissue, Dr. Evans said. I stared up at him. What do you mean? I mean that no blade did this because no matter how good they are at torture, there are always telltale signs of the instrument used. You're right when you say the bodies of the victims have the best clues, but not these bodies. It's almost as if their skin just dissolved away. Any corrosive agent that could take someone's skin and soft tissue like nose and groin wouldn't just stop at the skin. It would keep eating through the body. He nodded. Unless it was washed off immediately. But there's no residue of any known corrosive agent. More than that, the body isn't patterned on an acid burn. The nose and groin were torn away. There are signs of tearing and damage that aren't present elsewhere. It's almost as if whoever did the skinning skinned them, then tore off the extra pieces. He shook his head. I've traveled all over the world to help catch torturers. I thought I'd seen it all, but I was wrong.
Are you a forensic pathologist? I asked.
Yes.
But they're not dead, I said. He looked at me.
No, they're not dead. But the same skills that let me judge a dead body work here, too.
Ted Forrester said there were deaths. Did they die from the skinning? Now that I was working, the room didn't seem so hot. If I concentrated very carefully on the business stuff, maybe I wouldn't throw up on the patients.
No, they were cut into pieces and left where they fell.
Blade marks on the cut-up bodies, I assume, or you wouldn't have used the word cut.
There were marks of a cutting tool, but it was like no knife or sword or, hell, bayonet that I'd ever seen. The cuts were deep but not clean, something less refined than a steel blade was used.
What? I asked. He shook his head.
I don't know. The blade didn't cut through the bones, though. Whoever cut the bodies up pulled the bodies apart at the joints. No human would have the strength to do that, not multiple times.
Probably not, I said.
You really think a human being could have done this?
He asked, motioning at the bed. Are you asking me if a person could do this to another person? If you travel the world testifying in cases of death by torture, then you know exactly what people are capable of doing to each other.
I'm not saying a person wouldn't do this, he said. I'm saying I don't think it would be physically possible to do it.
I nodded. The cutting and tearing I think might have been human, but I agree with the skinning. If it were done by a human, then there would be tool marks of some kind.
You say tool marks, not blade marks. Most people assume it takes a blade to skin someone.
Anything that holds an edge can do it, I said, though it's slower and usually messier. This is strangely clean.
Yes, he said, nodding. Yes, that's a good phrase for it. As horrible as it is, it's still very neatly done, except for the extra tissue that was removed. That was not neatly done, but brutally done.
Almost like we have two different... I kept wanting to say killers, but these people were still alive. Perpetrators, I said finally.
What do you mean?
Cutting up a body with a dull tool that isn't strong enough to tear through bone, then pulling a person apart with bare hands is something more in the line of a disorganized serial killer. The careful skinning is something an organized serial killer might do. Why go to the trouble of carefully skinning the face and groin, then pulling off the pieces? It's either two different mutilators, or it's two different personalities.
A multiple personality?
He made it a question. Not exactly, but not all serial killers are so easy to put in one category or another. Some organized criminals have moments of savagery that resemble the disorganized killer, and some organized minds become more disorganized as they escalate their killing. The same isn't true of a disorganized killer. There aren't enough brownies in the pan for them to ape organized methods.
So either an organized killer with savage moments of disorganization or what?
The good doctor was talking very reasonably to me, not angry anymore. I'd either impressed him or at least hadn't disappointed him. Not yet, anyway. It could be a pair of killers. An organized killer being the brains of the operation, and the disorganized being the follower. It's not that unusual to find killers working in tandem.
Like the Hillside Strangler, or rather, stranglers, he said.
I smiled behind the mask. There have been a lot more cases than just that one where we had two killers. Sometimes it's two men. Sometimes it's a man and a woman. In that case, the man is the dominant personality. Or, at least in every case I've ever heard of, except one. Either way, one is dominant and the other is to a lesser or greater degree in the control of the other. It can be a near-complete domination, so that the other person is unable to say no, or it can be more of a partnership. But even in more equal relationships, one person is primarily dominant while the other is the follower.
And you're sure it's a serial mutilator?
He asked. No, I said.
What do you mean?
The serial mutilator idea is the most normal solution I can come up with, but I'm a preternatural expert, Dr. Evans. I'm rarely called in when the answer wears a human face, no matter how monstrous. Someone thinks this wasn't done by human hands, or I wouldn't be here.
The FBI agent seemed very sure,
Dr. Evans said. I looked at him. Have I just wasted both our times here? Did the feds come in and say pretty much what I just said?
Pretty much,
he said. Then you don't need me.
The FBI is convinced that it's a serial mutilator, a person.
Sometimes the feds can be very sure of themselves, and once they've committed themselves, they don't like to be wrong. Policemen in general can be like that. It is usually the easy answer when it comes to crime. If a husband dies, the wife probably did it. Cops aren't encouraged to complicate a case. They're encouraged to simplify it.
Why aren't you taking the simple solution?
He asked. Several reasons. One, if it was a serial anything, a human, I'd think the police, feds, whatever, would have some clues by now. The level of fear and uncertainty among the men is too high. If they had a clue to what was happening, they'd be less panicked. Two, I don't have a superior to report to. No one's going to slap my hand or demote me in rank if I guess and I'm wrong. My job and income don't depend on pleasing anyone but myself.
You do have a boss to answer to?
He said. Yeah, but I don't have to give regular written reports. He's more a business manager than anything. He doesn't give a rat's ass how I do the job, as long as I do it and don't insult too many people along the way. I raise the dead for a living, Dr. Evans. It's a specialized skill. If my boss gives me too much grief, there are two other animating firms in this country that would take me in a hot minute. I could even go freelance.
You're that good?
He said. I nodded. I seem to be. And that frees me from a lot of the red tape and politics that the police have to mess with. My goal is to keep this from happening to anyone else. If I look a little foolish or indecisive along the way, that's just fine. Though I'll probably get some pressure to make up my mind and pick a boogeyman. Not from my boss, but from the police and the feds. Solving something like this could make a cop's career. Being wrong and failing to solve it could be the end of a career.
But if you're wrong, you aren't hurt,
Evans said. I looked at him. If I'm wrong, then no harm, no foul. If everybody's looking in the wrong direction, me, the cops, the feds, everybody, then this is going to keep on happening. I look down at the man on the bed. That will hurt.
Why? Why will it hurt you?
Because we're the good guys, and whoever or whatever is doing this is the bad guy. Good is supposed to triumph over evil, Dr. Evans, or what's a heaven for?
You're Christian?
I nodded.
I didn't think you could be Christian and raise zombies.
Surprise, I said. He nodded, though I wasn't sure what he was agreeing with.
Do you need to see the others, or is this enough?
You can cover him back up, but yeah, I should at least look at the others. If I don't, then I'll wonder if I missed something by not looking.
No one else has made it all the way around the room without having to leave, and that includes me the first time I walked in here.
He was walking to the next bed as he spoke. I followed behind, not happy to be there, but feeling better. I could do this if I just concentrated on solving the crime and shoved my empathy in a tight, dark box. At that moment, sympathy was a luxury I couldn't afford. The second man was almost identical to the first except for height and eye color. Blue eyes this time, and I had to look away. If I locked gazes with any of them, they'd become people, and I'd run screaming. The third bed was different. The wounds on the chest seemed different somehow, and when Dr. Evans rolled the sheet over the groin, I realized it was a woman. My gaze went back to her chest where something had ripped away her breasts. Her eyes rolled wildly, mouth opening and closing, making small sounds, and I saw for the first time why no one was talking. The tongue was just a ruined stump, rolling like a butchered worm in that lipless, skinless opening. Heat washed over me in a rush. The room swam. I couldn't breathe. The mask molded itself to my open, gaping mouth. I turned and went for the doors. I walked slowly. I didn't run, but if I didn't get out of there, I was going to lose what little I had in my stomach, or maybe faint. Of the two, I think I preferred throwing up. Dr. Evans pressed the pad that opened the door without a word. The doors opened, and I went through. Ben, the nurse, turned to me, mask hastily held in place with a gloved hand. When the doors shut behind me, he let the mask drop.
You all right?
I shook my head, not trusting my voice. I jerked the mask off my face and still couldn't seem to get enough air. It was too quiet in the little room. The only sound, the soft hush of the air whooshing in, recycling. The small movement of cloth as Ben moved towards me. I needed noise, human voices. I needed to get out of there. I jerked the plastic thingy off my head. My hair fell around my shoulders, brushed my face. I still couldn't get enough air. I'm sorry, I said, and my voice sounded distant. I'll be back. I opened the outer door and escaped. Chapter 7. The hall felt cooler, though I knew it wasn't. I leaned beside the closed door, eyes closed, breathing in great drafts of air. The corridor was full of noise after that silent, hissing room. People walking, moving, and Lieutenant Marks's voice.
Not so fucking tough after all, eh, Miss Blake?
I opened my eyes and looked at him. He was sitting in the chair that had probably been brought up for the uniform guarding the door. The uniformed officer was nowhere to be seen. Only Edward leaned against the far wall, hands behind his back. He was watching my face, watching me, as if he'd memorized my fear. I made it through 3 patients before I had to leave the room. How many did you see before you had to go outside, Marks?
I didn't have to leave the fucking room.
Dr. Evans said that no one has made it through the room, all the way through the room, without having to run out. That means you didn't make it either, Marks. So piss off. He was on his feet now.
You witch.
He spat the last word at me as if it were the worst insult he could come up with.
Don't you mean bitch? I said.
I was feeling better out here in the hallway. Trading insults with Marks was a cakewalk compared to my other choices.
I said what I meant.
If you don't know the difference between a real witch and an animator, no wonder you haven't caught the thing that's doing this.
What do you mean, thing?
He asked. Thing. Thing. Monster.
The feds think it's a serial mutilator, he said.
I glanced at Edward. Nice of someone to tell me what the feds said. Edward didn't look guilty in the least. He was pleasant, unreadable, and I turned my attention back to Marks.
Then why aren't there any tool marks from the skinning?
Marks glanced down the corridor where a nurse was pushing a small cart.
We don't discuss an ongoing investigation in the open where anyone can hear us.
Fine. Then after I've gone back in there and looked at the last 3 bodies, we'll go someplace more private and talk about the case. I think he paled just a bit.
You're going back in there?
The victims are the clues, Lieutenant. You know that.
We can take you to the crime scenes, he said.
It was the nicest thing he'd ever said to me. Great, and I need to see them, but right this moment we're here, and the only possible clues are inside that room. My breathing had returned to normal, and the sick sweat had dried on my forehead. Maybe I was a touch pale myself, but I was mobile and felt almost normal. I walked into the middle of the hall and motioned Edward over to me, as if I had something for his ears alone. He pushed away from the wall and came toward me. When he was close enough, I faked a low kick. He looked down for just an instant, reacting to it, and the second higher kick caught him in the jaw. He went backwards hard. He had his arms up to defend his face. He knew enough to defend the vital areas and worry about standing later. My heart was thudding in my chest, not from exertion, but from adrenaline. I'd never used my newfound Kenpo skills in a fight. Trying it out for real for the first time on Edward was probably not my best idea, but hey, it had worked. Though truthfully, I was a little surprised it had worked that easily. In the back of my head, a voice wondered if Edward had let me take him down. The front of my head said that he had too much ego for that. I believed the second voice. I stayed where I was in a modified horse stance. It was pretty much the only stance I knew well enough to go back to once a kick was launched. I had my fists up, waiting, but didn't move in. When Edward figured out I wasn't going to do anything else, he lowered his arm and stared at me.
What the hell was that?
There was blood on his lower lip.
I've been taking Kenpo, I said.
Kenpo?
It's sort of like Taekwondo with fewer kicks and more fluid movements, a lot of handwork.
A black belt in judo wasn't enough?
He asked, and it was Ted's voice asking. Judo's great exercise, but it's not great for self-defense. You have to close with the bad guy and grapple. This way I can stay out of reach and still do damage. He touched his lip and came away with blood.
I see that. Why?
Why did I kick you in the face? I asked.
He nodded, and I think he winced ever so slightly.
Great.
Why didn't you warn me about the victims? Tell me what I was up against.
I walked in on them cold, he said. I wanted to see how you handled it cold.
This is not a pissing contest, Edward. Ted, I am not competing with you. I know you're better than me, tougher than me, colder than me. You win, okay? Stop with the macho bullshit.
I'm not so sure, he said softly.
Not sure about what? I asked.
Who's tougher? Remember, I didn't make it through the whole room either.
I stared at him. Fine. You want to go one-on-one? Great, but not now. We are supposed to be solving a case. We are supposed to be making sure that what happened to those people doesn't happen to anyone else. When we're back on our own time, then you can get competitive. Until we solve this, cut it the fuck out, or you are going to seriously piss me off.
Edward got slowly to his feet. I backed away out of reach. I'd never seen him use martial arts before, but I put nothing past him. A sound made me back up farther until I could see Edward and Marks without looking away from Edward. Marks was making a small sniggering sound. It took me a moment to realize he was laughing. Laughing so hard his face was purplish and he seemed to be having trouble breathing. Edward and I both stared at him. When Marks could finally talk, he said,
You kick a man in the face, and that's not seriously pissed off.
He straightened, hand to his side like he had a stitch in it.
What the fuck do you call seriously pissed?
I felt my face going blank, my eyes going empty. For just an instant, I let Mark see the gaping hole where my conscience was supposed to be. I didn't really mean to, but I couldn't seem to help it. Maybe I was more shaken up from the room and its survivors than I thought. It's the only excuse I can give. Mark's face went from fading laughter to something like concern. He gave me cop eyes, but underneath that was an uncertainty that was almost fear.
Smile, Lieutenant. It's a good day. No one died.
I watched the thoughts spill through his face. He understood exactly what I meant. You should never even hint to the police that you're willing to kill, but I was tired, and I still had to go back into the room. Fuck it. Edward spoke in his own voice, low and empty.
And you wonder why I compete with you?
I turned eyes that I knew were just as dead as his to meet his gaze. I shook my head. I don't wonder why you compete with me, Ted. I just told you to stop doing it until the case is solved.
And then?
He asked.
Then we'll see, won't we?
I didn't see fear on Edward's face. I saw anticipation. And that was the difference between us. He enjoyed killing. I didn't. What really scared me was the thought that that might be the only difference between us now. It wasn't enough of a difference for me to throw stones in Edward's direction. I still had more rules than Edward did. There were still things that he would do that I wouldn't, but even that list had been growing shorter of late. There was something close to panic fluttering in my stomach. Not fear of Edward or anything he could do, but wondering when I'd turn the corner and become just another monster. I'd told Dr. Evans we were the good guys. But if Edward and I were on the side of the angels, then what was left to be on the other side?
Something that could skin a person alive without using a tool of any kind. Something that would jerk the penis off a man and the breasts off a woman with its bare hands. As bad as Edward was, as bad as I'd become, there were worse things. And we were about to go hunting one of them.
Chapter 8. I did go back into the room, and no, I didn't learn a damn thing from the last three victims. All that wasted bravery for nothing. Well, not exactly for nothing. I proved to myself that I could go back into the room without throwing up or fainting. I didn't care if it impressed Edward or Marks. It impressed me. If you can't impress yourself, then no one else really matters. I either impressed Dr. Evans, or he needed a restorative cup of tea, because he invited me back to the doctor's and nurse's lounge. There's no such thing as truly undrinkable coffee, but I hoped the tea was better for Evans's sake. Though I doubted it. The coffee came out of a can, and the tea was from little bags with strings on them. There's only so much you can hope for from prepackaged tea and coffee. At home, I grind my own beans, but I wasn't home, and I was grateful for the bitter warmth. I added cream and sugar and noticed that the coffee was trembling in the cup, as if maybe my hands weren't quite steady. I was also cold. Nerves. Just nerves. If Edward had nerves, you couldn't tell it, as he leaned against the wall, drinking his coffee black. He'd scorned sugar and cream, tough he-man that he was. He winced as he sipped, and I don't think it was the scalding liquid. His lip was swelling slightly from where I'd kicked him. It made me feel better. Childish, but true. Marks had taken a place on the room's only couch, blowing on his coffee. He'd taken cream and sugar in his. Evans settled down into the only chair that looked halfway comfortable, sighing as he stirred his tea. Edward watched me, and I finally realized that he wouldn't sit down until I did. Screw it. I sat down in a chair that was far too straight back to be comfortable, but was placed so I could watch everyone in the room, including the door. There was a small but full-size refrigerator against the far wall. It was an older model, done in an odd shade of brown. A small L-shaped cabinet area housed a coffee maker, a second coffee maker with nothing but hot water in it, a sink, and a microwave oven. Dr. Evans had used the hot water for his tea. There were white plastic spoons in an open packet, and a mug of those useless little coffee stirrers. There'd been a choice of sugar, NutraSweet, and some other artificial sweetener that I'd never heard of. There was a circle of artificial creamer that had dried into a round, crusty ridge where someone had sat a mug down in it. I concentrated on the minutiae of the cabinet, trying not to think. For just a few moments, I wanted to sip my coffee and not think. I still hadn't eaten today, and now I didn't want to.
"You said you had some questions for me, Miss Blake,"
Dr. Evans spoke into the silence. I jumped, and so did Marks. Only Edward stayed half-leaning against the wall, unmoved, blue eyes watching us all as if he were apart from the tension and the horror. Maybe he was, or maybe it was just an act. I just didn't know anymore. I nodded, trying to focus. How did they all survive? He tilted his head to one side.
Do you mean technically how did they survive? Medical detail?
I shook my head. No, I mean one person surviving this much trauma, or even two, I'll buy. But most people wouldn't survive it, or am I wrong? Evans pushed his glasses more securely on his nose, but nodded.
No, you aren't wrong.
Then how did all six of them survive? I asked. He frowned at me.
I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're trying to say here, Miss Blake.
I'm asking what are the chances that six people of varying sex, background, physical fitness, age, etc., would all be able to survive the same amount of trauma? My understanding is that all the victims that were just skinned have survived, right?
Yes.
Dr. Evans was watching me closely, pale eyes searching my face, waiting for me to go on. Why did they survive?
They're tough sons of bitches, Mark said.
I glanced at the lieutenant, then back to Evans. Are they?
Are they what?
The doctor asked. Are they tough sons of bitches? He lowered his eyes as if thinking.
Two of the men worked out regularly. One of the women was a marathon runner. The other three were just ordinary. One of the men is close to 60 and didn't have a regular exercise routine of any kind. The other woman is in her 30s but didn't...
He looked at me.
No, They aren't particularly tough individuals, not physically anyway. But I've found that it's often the people who aren't physically strong or outwardly tough that survive the longest under torture. The He-Men are usually the first to cave.